It's recording.
Morning, colleagues.
Morning.
Let me welcome everyone here, members and the summer delegation. There's a new acting CEO, or what you call yourself, managing chief executive officer, CEO, I'm right, Mr. Nomadela. We welcome you and your delegation of one person. We are aware that there's a measure of summer with the COLA and IDC SME unit, and we understand that you're sort of rounding off as a standalone entity. So we're expecting that in terms of structural issues, you will have some challenges. So that's why we understand when you bring in one person. Thank you very much. Without any waste of time, because you are new, we also understand that you've been seconded from the IDC. Yes. Let me, for your own sake, introduce members, because I don't think you've ever interacted with them. I'll start at the far end there, with Dr. Rabi, whose party he loves so much that he's even wearing his thing. Today, lumber jacket. Is it what you call it? Yes. And then next to Dr. Rabi, we have the member Gwabaza. Next to member Gwabaza, we have member Sodetsi. Next to member Sodetsi, we have the whip of the committee, member Ndili. We have other members who unfortunately could not be here with us due to other commitments. We also have our support staff. On my immediate left, I have the researcher of the committee, Ma'am Belekan. Yes, and Wabisa. On my right, we have the secretary of the committee, who's also new. Perhaps he attended his first meeting this week. First formal meeting, of course, this week on Tuesday. And then we have at the back there, Beauty. Beauty Zan, I forget his name all the time. And then we have Venetia Williams. Beauty is the committee assistant. And then we have my PA, Venetia Williams. And then we have members from the PMG.
Mike Steady.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Christopher, and I'm from Chebinet.
From?
Chebinet.
Okay. Thank you. That's the how the committee is constituted with its support. May I then hand over to Pilot for apologies before I hand over to Mr. Mamadin.
Thank you, Chair. I have two apologies for today. One is from Honorable Mabasa,
who is attending a traditional marriage function for his son, and the other is from Honorable Marai, who is attending a political party business. Thank you.
He's not attending the ceremonies yet. I think Mabasa is going to prepare for his son's traditional marriage. Thank you very much. Date Mama Della, may we hand over to you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start off by thanking the committee for giving us the opportunity to present some of the institution that we think is very relevant in the South African economic space. With me is Patrick Matoma, who is also the acting CEO of SAMAF. So I'm acting as a CEO, he's acting as a COO. And the two of us actually constitute the executive of SAMAF because the number of people, as you would have picked up in the financial statements, a number of executives resigned last year, and because of the impending measure, no replacements were sought. Let me start off the presentation then by by looking at the outline. We'll look at the mandate of SAMAF, the vision and mission, values and objectives. We'll look at the operating model. I found this to be important because, you know, sometimes it doesn't come out clear how SAMAF actually operates. We'll look at the performance highlights and briefly look at the national footprint of SAMAF. And then we'll move on to the financial performance, and we'll single out a number of issues from the auditor's report and look at those challenges that basically relate to, or that stems out from the auditor's report, and look at the way forward. We are aware that some of it basically created for the sake of creating work opportunities and sustainable livelihood by providing funding to micro and small and survivalist business, basically to create some sort of employment and provide livelihood for those people. And one of the elements of the mandate would then be for someone to become a catalyst in development or developing a vibrant microfinance industry, because SAMAF is the only government-funded institute in this industry. To this extent, we aim to facilitate provision of access to finance by micro and survivalist businesses, to extend financial and non-financial services to reach the deeper and broader areas, rural areas, informal settlements, very urban settlements in South Africa. We contribute towards the reduction of poverty and unemployment, to build a strong and effective and efficient wholesale or APEX fund, which we are, to contribute to better quality of life for our people, and to contribute towards the sustainable and vibrant microfinancial industry in South Africa. I hope that, particularly this last one, I hope that with the new institution that's to be formed, will take note of this one and make sure that we do not lose this vision of creating the vibrant microfinance or to be becoming catalyst in there. Our vision, therefore, is to be the leader in Development Microfinance in South Africa. And our mission really to mobilize financial industry intermediaries, because while providing funding to these financial intermediaries, in many instances we have to get to we have to be active in helping to set them up to become the financial intermediaries that we can support. By the way, we even look at stock sales, and we mobilize stock sales so that they should become the financial intermediaries that we can support. We provide wholesale funding, of course, to these institutions once they are qualified, to development of institutional capacity for these institutions. And we need to be, as a mission, we need to be in a position to lobby and advocate for policy development in the interest of microfinance industry. And of course, one of the missions would then be to develop valuable partnerships between government, business communities, and of course, and businesses and communities. The values. Values are, of course, integrity, transparency, professionalism, because while we advocate for transparency, we have to make sure that we are professional enough such that being transparent does not mean we are careless with the confidentiality of information that we're sharing between ourselves and our clients. Accountability and high performance. You'll notice later that for last year, for once, we really became a bit, we improved our performance materially, and hopefully we'll take this attitude forward to the new institutions. Our objective, really, to contribute to alleviation of poverty through funding the intermediaries. It is important to note that SAMAF does not do funding directly to end users, but we fund through intermediaries. So we enabling those intermediaries to fund the end users, being micro industries and survivalist businesses. Capacitating these financial intermediaries so they should be able to do the funding properly. And regulation and prudential standards. Although this was a temporary thing that some of us doing, it's actually gonna go away now to CBDA, but up to this stage we were the ones responsible for regulation. Objective is to exceed our stakeholders' expectations for improving the outreach and with our satellite offices and regional office networks. We have an regional office in every province throughout the country. We expect also to exceed our customers by their expectations by improving our internal turnaround and standard. Improvement of process to achieve service delivery through excellence, leverage performance through capacity and people through organizational development, of course, balanced scorecard and performance management, organizational design and change management, and building sustainable APEC fund, which we are, and which this is a point I addressed earlier about my wish that going forward, the new institution will be mindful of. In short, then, this is how SAMAF is structured. I did not include here the oversight by the portfolio committee, but at the top would be the main accounting officer, being the Director General Richard Levine at the moment. And as you move forward, you have the oversight units or oversight entities that look after SAMAF. external, some of them, being the advisory board. We have the advisory board, the audit committee, and the risk management committee. All of these are meant to support or to direct the support in entities, being the registration, the IT, insert some of that is finance and HR and capacity building. And these impact on the operations, which is mainly the regional offices who interface with the FI financial institutions on your right. And at the end of this whole value chain, it is the consumer that benefits. I now move on to the highlights of the 2011 performance summit. We made disbursements of a little over, close to 40.8 million rand in respect of loans and grants. And this is substantially, you'll see later, substantially higher than what the performance was for the last 3 years. we supported 14 microfinance institutions, 23 financial corporate service cooperatives, and 24 stock firms. This is throughout the country. The total number of borrowers has increased by 13.5% from 35884 to 40726. And 80% of loans by FIs and end users were in rural communities, and 95 of that were microfinance, micro enterprise loans. This is important because we mentioned earlier that our focus really is on rural communities, is on peri-urban communities, to some extent urban, but in the bottom of the pyramid area. The number of end users which we mobilized or assisted or to mobilize through our funding increased by 20% from 25 to 31,000. Installment repayments by FIs improved by an average of 90%. You see earlier when you do the comparison with the previous years, this is quite an achievement, particularly for a higher risk or the companies that operate in a higher risk area like ourselves. 272 individuals from 68 institutions nationally participated in capacity building workshops. Very important for us because one of the objectives of SAMAF is to capacitate these financial institutions and develop them to a point where they can be independent, but they need a lot of capacitation at the early stage, training them in areas such as financial management and administration. And one of the very important highlights is that some have received an unqualified audit report. This is the first time since the establishment of SAMAF 5 years ago. The other one which we did not mention here, you would have picked up in the financial statements though, is that we had a market survey recently, and by far this was the most positive response we received with regard to attitude of our clients towards SAMAF, its services and its products. The funding, the approved funding for the year has increased, improved. If you look at 2008, 30.6 million, 2009, 10 million, and when you compare that to last year at 48.1 million, this is a marked improvement of 41%. This is mainly the reason for the improvement, mainly the improvement in our turnaround times. which and also the positive attitude and commitment from our staff, particularly at regional offices. Total disbursements has increased by 192% from 19.4 million to 40.8 million. This is a considerable amount. The makeup of the disbursements was 18.4 million being capacity building grants and 22.4 million for being loans provided for on lending. Loans for on lending per province, as you can see, in some of the provinces, unfortunately, we didn't do much. Northern Cape, we've had a lot of challenges in Northern Cape. I was with IDC until lately, and I know even IDC has challenges with Northern Cape because of the vastness of the area. Northern Cape tends to be just a concentration, or a lot of activities concentrated in Kimberley, and as for the rest, it's very difficult. And also to move from Kimberley to Prescott and whatever, it tends to be very, very difficult. But we're working on that matter, and there are other moves in line to see what we can do, maybe even to combine the Northern Cape and the Free State office, just to make sure there's better capacity there. Northwest, sadly, also we didn't disperse anything as we did with the Free State, although we have done a lot of activity in this area, as may be seen in the financial report. But certainly there were no disbursements in that area. Capacity building, this is the effort or the activity by summer to capacitate those financial institutions that we want to prepare to become fundable. We've done quite a bit there. We spent quite a bit of money in all of these areas. Most of it going to Limpopo province, Gauteng province, followed by Limpopo and Western Cape, but these are the big provinces, and Mpumalanga. The cumulative net loan book at the moment in millions is 43.3%. This is an increase of 41% from last year. This is mainly due to the disbursements we had last year and the approvals, of course, that have led to this. Number of end users. These are the end users, that the number of end users that our funding has created or has enabled. That has increased by 13.5% from 35,000 to 41,000 in the current financial year. Loan repayments, this is an indication of just how good the internal control systems have improved. In sum up, we increased our loan repayments from 66 to 90%. And 90%, I must say, is quite an achievement in the area, in the industry that we're dealing with. This is Samar's footprint nationally. We've got microfinance institutions and financial service corporations. You know, when we compiled this, we had M and F, and I thought we should really do that quickly because, you know, it was sometimes would have been mistaken for male and female. So we have four in Limpopo, in microfinance institutions in Northwest is 0, and financial service corporations is 4. I understand, and I have been invited to a launch of a micro cooperative bank in Northwest. That's the first one of its kind in the country, and they have applied to us for assistance. We are very excited about it. So although we have 0 and 4, that's going to improve materially. Gauteng 3 and 5, Mpumalanga 4 and 1, Free State we're still struggling there a little bit. So do we in Northern Cape, as mentioned earlier. So we have 3 there, FSCs and 5 respectively. And we have 6 FSCs in KZN. We have 1 microfinance institution in Eastern Cape and 6 FSCs and 3 and 3 in Western Cape. We now look at the financial information or financial performance. The grant funding we received from EDD was a little lower than the previous year at 58 million rand. The interest on lending interest of 22 million rand and other grant funding of 58 million, let me qualify it. 58 million is for operations, to pay for operations, and 22 million is meant for disbursement for on lending. We have other grant income of 62,000. Interest on our loans, or loans that we have provided, amounted to almost 5 million or 4.6 million, if you like. And that is 5%, that would be the income we have generated in the year. And we have other income from small activities. There we have a loss of 2.5 million from granting loans. This is mainly due to the impairment. In the previous years, the impairment was not done correctly according to the auditors, and last year a big adjustment was put through to make sure that we account correctly for the loans in our books. So the impairment, that total exercise has resulted in the net loss of 2.5 million, or nearly 2.6 million. And the 58 million you see there, that's for operating expenses. And therefore, our surplus was 24 million. And when you add to the interest we receive from the funding that's still, or our funds that's still sitting in the Reserve Bank of 10 million, we have a net surplus of about 35 million rand. This is just a breakdown of operating activity or expenses, meaning that the 30 million was for compensation and salaries throughout summer, and the purchase of goods and services 17 million. The 17 million is considered about two and a half million less than our expenditure last year, which is a marked improvement. We provided grant funding of 18 million, which is almost 3 times what we provided previous year. Our write-offs were substantially less than what we did the year before at 1 million rand. And there's a reversal of impairment that I talked about earlier that has contributed to that 2.5 million rand impairment loss. Ladies and gentlemen, I now move on to the report of the auditor general. This information is also contained in the financial statement. So we single out some of the issues that we consider to be important, that we consider to be of material, at least, that we need to bring forward to this committee. First, as we mentioned earlier, we received an unqualified report for the first time since some of us formed. However, there are issues or matters of emphasis where the auditors say, look, I'm not going to qualify the report, but there are issues that I think you and management should look into and make sure that you address them. The first issue is going concern. We have mentioned that the chairperson had mentioned earlier. The auditor normally would say if there are issues of going concern, you would mention that he's not sure whether the institution is gonna be existent in the following year. This is normal. It's standard for auditors. In this case, he had to say that there is this impending measure, and we mention also that some of operations will not cease to exist. So what may disappear is some of them. So because we're going to be merged into this one entity, but the activities will continue. There was a material losses to the amount of 1 million rand were incurred as a result of write-off. We mentioned that in the income statement earlier. In addition to that, the material impairment to the amount of 4.7 million were incurred. We mentioned that this was because of the wrong treatment of impairments from the beginning of summer, over the period of 4 years. So on the first year, this big amount had to be brought in to adjust put through an accounting adjustment to the balance of our loans. Usefulness of information. The reported performance. Information was deficient in respect of the following, according to the auditor. The indicators, our performance indicators, were not well defined. And according to the AG again, the performance information was deficient in respect of accuracy. The amount, numbers, and other data relating to actual performance have not been recorded and reported appropriately. And as well as completeness, all actual results and events that should have been recorded have not been included in the reported performance information. Ladies and gentlemen, I must say that at a later stage we will see what we're planning to do to make sure that these areas are addressed. The compliance with laws and regulations. A service with a transaction of value between 10 and 500,000 was procured without inviting at least three quotations as per treasury regulations. I must say that we've subsequently discovered that, in fact, the DG condoned this activity. The accounting officer did not take appropriate steps to prevent irregular spending as required by Section 38 of PFMA. Payment of 107,000 was made without the correct procurement process being followed. Again, we have announced, we know that the DG actually condoned this expenditure. internal controls, the leadership did not exercise appropriate oversight in ensuring that the prior year's and current year annual financial statements complied with the reporting framework. The entity did not have sufficient skilled resources. We mentioned earlier that I am acting, and over the period that we're reporting on, the acting chief executive officer was also filling the position of chief financial officer. Unfortunately, up to this stage, we are not in a position to appoint a chief financial officer. We are going to move on until after the merger. Only then will we know whether we can move on with the appointment of these official executive officials. Finance and performance management did not have adequate controls to ensure that the accuracy or completeness of financial statements and the report of performance information. This was mentioned slightly earlier. I think this is how the AG dissects this report. Management did not ensure that certain accounting policies were correctly adopted. Again, this is mainly due to the fact that we didn't have a CFO. Management's internal control systems relating to IT were inadequate in providing reasonable assurance that the IT high risk areas were properly managed and controlled. Stemming from the Auditor General's report, we then looking at, we had a quick assessment of sum up, and we say, okay, this is what came out of the report, and we look at those things as challenges that need to be addressed. Then we look at a few others, given the fact that we are looking at the measure as well. So we couldn't go full swing to sit and craft strategy to challenge these things. But in the meantime, this is what we've got as challenges that we need to address between now and the end of the financial year, which is externally the lack of governance and administration skills within FIs. This makes our job slightly difficult of funding because the FIs are not exactly ready. But to combat this, we have a capacity building unit which is working at this to try and capacitate these financial services to get to a point where they can be funded. General lack of micro financial skills, both internally and externally. Some of it is fairly new, it's about 5 years old, and we think that there's still a bit to learn for some of officials themselves, or ourselves at least. We still have a bit to learn from other countries how to improve on the service delivery from the summer point of view. Because in Africa, there are countries where microfinance is much more active than in South Africa. I was looking at the report recently. We're looking at about 0.6%, while Kenya is somewhere around of the total finance industry. Kenya, we're looking at about 15%, and in one West African country, is looking at about 22%. So I think that even internally, we still have to find a way to make sure that we increase that participation because we need it. And of course, this also affects the micro finance industry external to some of, because they also are not that ready. But this is the role of some of to make sure that we improve on we act as catalyst to improve on the take up of microfinance in the country. One of the challenges will be capacity constraints at provincial offices. But this one is a bit difficult for us because of the merger. We in some provincial offices we don't have regional managers. We only have outreach coordinators. but we are not in a position to employ regional managers because of the impending measure. So hopefully, after the measure, we'll reconstitute the regional offices correctly, such that we can provide service delivery. Of course, one of the challenges we mentioned earlier is vast distances traveled to the FIs within provinces, especially areas like Northern Cape, and Limpopo is also as vast as Northern Cape, maybe less vast, but they quite long distances to be traveled in order to capacity or to work with those FIs. It is common knowledge now that we didn't have sufficient skills or skilled resources, particularly at the executive level, and unfortunately that is also pending the measure. One of the major challenges, of course, is that measure itself. The staff morale is unstable. In some cases, we get continuous challenges from staff because of the uncertainty of the measure. But that is to be expected. So the sooner we get to a point where we finalize the measure and people know where they'll be going, the better for us, for SAMAF, and for everybody. Because then people will be more stable, because now they know what's going to happen to them in the future. Lastly, ladies and gentlemen, the way forward. Given the limited time period we have, we said these are the activities we need to emphasize on as some of leadership to make sure that we improve even the areas that the AG has singled out, and also to make sure that SAMAF is relevant in South Africa, is relevant in the microfinance industry, and is relevant for a government institution that needs to be a catalyst to develop microfinance in the country. So we said we will revise business processes to reduce turnaround times. We've already started doing that. I was with IDC, as you may know, and IDC has already started doing that. They call it cutting red tape. So we immediately said, when I arrived at SAMAF, said, you know what, if IDC can do it, we can do it. So we are already working on, we already sent our first draft to the regions, to make sure that we are in line or in sync with the regional managers. But we're hoping that the red tape will be cut, and the cutting red tape will actually mean we will provide more funding. We are in the process of implementing a capacity building impact analysis tool, because we need to know what the areas of deficiencies are in the financial institutions, to make sure that we provide them with the intervention they require for them to be able to grow up to a point where we can fund them, and they grow up to a point where they can be like the cooperative bank we mentioned in Northwest. We in the process of implementing change management to address the major issues. We mentioned that the staff morale is a bit dicey there. We need to come up with something to make sure that we stabilize this area so that people can look forward to supporting the institution. We are addressing the audit findings by reviewing the existing policies and also developing new policies where there is a need. Because my observation is that there are a few areas where policies were absent or silent. So we need to do that to make sure that we cover to make sure that people, the staff, know what they're going to do. And we're tightening controls by communicating these policies once we finalize them, and also the accompanying punitive measures that may be necessary in the event of transgressions. We also ensure that the corporate and target individuals are aligned, because you know where it is mentioned earlier in the AG's report that the performance measures are unclear. So we need to make sure we clarify the corporate performance measures, align them to individual targets, and agree those upfront with staff members, so that they should go out there and implement, knowing what to do, what is expected of them, and all of that being aligned to what we as SAMAF have to deliver for our clients out there. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of my presentation. I hope you find it interesting. I think it is time that we get the questions. I think so. I'm not sure. I return all of this to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, I think it's true that we understand now why we have in such a detailed and organized report. I think it's for first time members. If we look back, for the first time we get such an organized report from SAMAF, quite clearly put everything understandable. I think that's why members were listening attentively. That's the interest they're showing into your presentation. Well, let's hear them as to whether they agree with me or not. But perhaps let me start by congratulating yourself. And I think it will be also be fair to also extend the congratulations to Mr. Naidu, because I know he started, he made sure that this, under very difficult conditions and situations, that the finances at least are audited today, and that you receive a positive outcome from the Auditor General. Yes, with emphasis, but this emphasis, we can also see that this is something that is being worked on, and to us it's promising, because we didn't want you to get into a broader entity, you know, without clean documents or data. We are, from my side, I think members will agree with me that we really appreciate this development. Thank you very much. Can we hear from the members? Dr. Rabi, Babu Ukwabaza, Me Zodetsi, and then the whip. Come last.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you have thanked Mr. Naidu, but I also, on behalf of, I think, of all the members of the committee, I think he has done good work. I think there's quite an improvement on the report that we had last year from SAMAF. Madam Chair, the spokesperson said that some of the policies are some policies are non-existent. I'd like to get some further clarities. What can you give us some examples of where you can improve on? And then secondly, Madam Chair, I think he mentioned an example of Kenya and a West African country, which had something like about 4 or 5% participation in them. I'd like to sort of, if it's possible, and Chair, don't you think we should go and have a look at Kenya, how Kenya is doing with this West African country? Because I think we can learn something from Africa, because business in our country is very concentrated, and if we can pay an inside visit and look at what's going on there. If he can give us some examples of the Kenyan example or this particular West African example, where you can get more involvement from the informal sector, I can think it's going to only be to our benefit. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry about that. She was just going to answer something from the research. Ms. Babu Kavasa.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I also want to appreciate the report and the frankness and the honesty that one senses when you hear the presentation. On page 10, on slide 8, page 8. I wanted to ask if you look at the years from 2006 right up to 2011, you see a slide down right up to 2008 2009, and then there's then a positive turn. I want to understand what could have contributed to that positive turn. Again, you see the rise again of approved funding, which is quite positive. That's one. Two, in your financial report, there's spending which... I think it's slide 20, which the Auditor General remarked upon, and you say that the DG condoned those two spends. What would have been the reason for the condonations? Lastly, on slide 22, again, I'm going back to the question that Dr. Rabi was asking. You're saying that generally in a number of African countries, there's much more activity of the microfinance institutions as compared to South Africa. What do you think is the restraining conditions which make our microfinance not quite as active as the African as the other African countries, because we are relatively more resourced than they are, but they seem to be doing better than us. What are the restraining conditions that you might have identified, and how do you propose we should overcome those?
We have a number of questions, but maybe it would be like one is sitting the messenger. But I think moving forward to the measure, we'll still make a follow-up of our pending questions that we'll reserve for now. So on page 10, there was a sort of a proposal from Mr. I want to say Mama Bola, I don't know why. It's not my turn. Yeah, about combining the offices that is in Northern Cape and Free State. For me, I don't think it's a good idea looking into the high rate of unemployment in Northern Cape, obviously high levels of poverty, that they might have the challenges of transport. It happens in urban areas like Gauteng. People have a problem just to move from the townships to offices in town, in Sandton. I think this one will be really a challenge to them. I'll try to skip other questions too. Like I say, maybe we should do the messenger here.
And maybe just a comment here about management does not have adequate controls to ensure accuracy or completeness of financial statements. That how long have they been in the system before we discover this mess here? And it means there was no performance evaluation for people to monitor. Like when I employed, I mean, we have monthly reports that we submit, and through those reports, I think something must have been detected before irreparable damage that we have now. And I was looking at a point under financial and performance management. I was looking at a point that will be taken to certain amounts that are not accounted for, because in this situation, obviously, there must be amounts that are not accounted for. And on challenges, page 22, on the uncertainty and low staff morale due to the impending measure of summer. I remember the other day I asked how would this measure impact on, you know, appointment of people. Is there going to be some kind of structuring where others would maybe be left out? But there was assurance that no one's going to be left out. So I really don't understand why the uncertainty, whether this assurance that everyone will be taken on board. And again, the example of other African states that are doing well in this refinancing, that it's unfortunate that we don't have here a list of maybe treats that were taken by management, you know, for oversight to learn best practices from other countries. Because the intention of going there is not for us to have a holiday, it's to copy from other countries the best things or good things that they're doing, so to implement them in our own country. So I think there were some tweaks by management. The question is, why the tweaks if you don't learn from others the good things that they are doing?
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson, and I would also like to echo the sentiments from my colleagues. Jefferson, firstly, I'll say, do you think, are you following the mandate? I mean, you're supposed to go to rural areas to organize there, but if you look at the figures, it doesn't say that, except Limpopo. Maybe you can tell us why Limpopo is coming right, because if you look at the figures, you can see that Western Cape is not a rural, but that's where the most activities. If you can clarify that, do you have any community outreach program to the particular to the end users? I'm saying this that we've gone for an oversight and found that people did not know that the money is from Summers. They thought the money is from the intermediaries. They thought it's for this, and plus the interest charge by these intermediaries. So you find that they vary, they do what they like. And maybe to ask you, who is your target? Is it the end users or the FSC? Then the chairperson, sometimes the entity will say it's a surplus if there is money left, and we interpret it as an under expenditure. They say you've got a surplus, and you find that to them they are proud that we've been able to save so much money instead of using that money for the work it is intended for. And I've talking about the savings. I remember we went to KwaZulu-Natal at Newcastle. We found that people have been there, have been saving for years, but they are not being assisted because if the target is high, say we have to serve 100,000 first before you are being assisted. Now you say it means then these people have come together, they are saving, but they are not being assisted because say, the target is there, and you can see that they will not reach it maybe after 6 years. In fact, maybe the person whose target is that he will no longer be there, or these people will just disappear. And we want to check that. What is your take on that? And lastly, Chair, is the incentive to the stock seller? I heard you saying you are organizing a mobilized stock sales. But what are the incentives? Because I remember I was one of the members of the stock sales, and the Standard Bank manager came to us. We were a huge organization. They said, no, we want to assist, we want to give you some incentives. And then when we look at it, they bought us just a bag to keep the books and the diary. They said that was the incentive. Then we could see that we could easily buy that thing anyway. So I just want to check what are your incentives for the stock sales and the plural organization steps.
Thanks,
Bob
Dole.
Okay.
Those are the questions related to the presentation made. I just want to follow up on questions that are related to my own questions, as I noted them earlier. I just want to check when I look at your slides dealing with the achievements. I wonder how practical or what's the real impact of your achievements for instance in the areas that you have targeted, or how do you measure your achievements? Because I'm also reading from the foreword by the Deputy Minister here, who says we target the lowest end in the market and assist them with all the risks involved to change their daily lives by strengthening their small and survivalist businesses. Therefore, this question is, and he continues to say, the intention of the fund is to reach out to all our people in the deepest rural and peri-urban areas. It is also to ensure that all South Africans are benefiting from our democracy. You know, reading this would sort of give us an overall response to what Babin Dudu was asking about, that's of the main target market. It's rural, it's peri-urban. It's not really the urban and the affluent ones. But in terms of the report, it directs us, and this I think we talked about in your last presentation, wherein we pleaded that please focus in the rural areas. That's where you are needed, especially the remote, because this is an intervention from government. It's not just a normal program. It's an intervention to help those people who want to generate income in order to survive, who want to also perhaps learn one or two things in terms of business. practices and so forth. That's why I'm asking, how do you measure your achievement in this regard? Is it according to how many people you have? For instance, funded. I'm just building up on what Babuntul has asked. How many people you funded? That is your intermediaries or your FSCs? Or is it those people that are being assisted by the FSCs? Because last time, I think it was last year when we went around the country checking the impact of the work of farmers. And it was very clear that some of the end users are not really surviving. For instance, in the Western Cape, where you have a large number, for instance, of peasants, we had situation where the FSC was charging something like up to 40% interest. And we requested that perhaps we should go back and look at this common approach issues. Because we went to KwaZulu-Natal, we found something different in terms of how this FSCs and intermediaries were operating. And to me, it says there's no consistency in terms of applying, you know, the financing methods of the because at the end of the day, it's about farmers. This is government money trying to help the poor. At the end of the day, some organizations or small businesses are really ripping our people up by even with the bigger things that they have. One small company I remember very well, led by women who were sewing clothes here in, I think it was Khayelitsha, they couldn't even survive even after getting the money. You know what they do, they don't get anything. They have to even borrow money again to support, to take their children to school. What's the use of being in a small survivalist business if you really can't even survive? And yet you have FSC who are quite, you know, they're making it. I really don't understand how we measure the impact. That's why I'm asking that, and whether we are addressing that going forward. Because even if we are meshed, but we're still going to be functioning, I hope, as a program within the meshed entity. The other question is related to the question that was asked on the condonement of irregular and fruitless expenditure practices by the DG. I want to understand which DG. Is it the DG of the department who condoned that? Okay. Under which circumstances? I just want to understand, because was it condoned prior or after? Obviously, condonement can only be done after. It makes sense in that way. But it's obviously irregular in terms of audit practices. And I think this is something that we need to follow up. I think the DG saw the need to do so because of particular reasons. But the material losses, to me, is quite high. In the previous financial year, yes, I think they are being minimized, but that is also irregular, the way the audit outcome, you know, found it. And what does it say? To me, it means that certain procedures were not followed when writing off, and what is being done to those people. At least we hear that there's the disciplinary action was taken on the overpayment to suppliers, but it's not clear in terms of the written off loan as to what action has been taken. We would like to be furnished with that information as to what action has been taken to that regard. I'm trying to find another amount as to where is it recorded in terms of the, you're saying something like there was an expenditure of okay, I'll come back to it. Okay, the same question again that I had around the surplus. What would you perhaps classify as a surplus? Because to me it's under expenditure. And I really find it odd that at the national level, the Treasury and the Auditor General become very inconsistent in really in bringing clarity in as far as this matter is concerned. And perhaps this is something that we have to follow up with the AG in our meeting. Because a surplus is something that you were meant to spend, but you saved. You know, you for instance, you applied certain measures that helped you in saving costs. But that cannot be, a surplus cannot be something that you spend, you could not spend. You deprived people or you deprived the end beneficiaries because you didn't want to spend that money. That to me cannot be a surplus because it's under expenditure and that is not correct. And this is something that perhaps we would want you to work on going forward because it's not on. We have so many people that are waiting this money that they need to be helped, but they're not able to be helped, like the KwaZulu-Natal Newcastle people who've been waiting for years, very organized, very eloquent in their display of knowledge of the work they're doing. But they wait for years before. Others, you know, they come in 3 months, they're funded. Others, they have to wait for years before they're funded. You know, there's that inconsistency in applying, you know, your, or in implementing your policies. Because somewhere we'll be told policies don't allow, others, they allow. I really don't understand what is the problem in there. I just also want to understand lastly what, obviously SAMAF and the Microfinancing Act, I think is it an act? What do you call it, that act that governs microfinancing? It is Microfinancing Act because it calls for a constitution that people must be constituted into a group of not less than 7 people or not less than 7 and not more than 10, I think something, 10 or 20 if I'm not mistaken. And it calls for a constitution, that they must be, they must have a valid constitution before they become. And that it's a bit complicated, because it then explains to me, it's not user friendly. When I went through it, it wasn't user friendly for these people, especially women, because these are women who are utilizing it. And if you want to help women really to establish themselves into a, no, it's a cooperative. It's a cooperative act, yes. Because your micro lending, therefore, is using a cooperative act. But the fact is, you have to follow a few laws for you to get established. And it's very difficult in a situation where you don't have. You find that NDA, National Development Agency, for instance, would apply or would utilize the act, cooperative act, in a different manner. And then you find SAMA, for instance, would also apply it in a different manner when establishing cooperatives. It is the fact. Where is consistency, and who follows that? I know that it's under, is it under DTI, the act? Perhaps it's something that you need to be following up and checking whether is it assisting, the way it is formulated, whether it's assisting our cooperatives. No wonder most of the cooperatives can't, you know, last long because of the requirements of that act. That's not helping them to even survive. And it is even made worse by the people who are supposed to be implementing it. Maybe regulations are needed so that even the implementers are regulated in some way. So I just want you to share with us your difficulties in as far as application of this act. Concerned. I don't know whether the COO has been there for some time, maybe can be in a position to assist us in as far as that is concerned. I want to agree also with the members of DICSI that merging or combining the two provinces, I don't think it will also help us to be able to measure the impact of your work in the two. That is objectively measure the impact of your work in the two provinces properly, because Northern Cape, yes, the way it is populated, sparsely populated, and it is unique, and it needs its own unique ways of being attended to. Because I know our officials don't want to settle in those types of environments, because they want easy urban life, but you can still find a person who's residing within those areas to service those people, instead of getting people from outside to go and service those areas, if we are serious about reaching out to those people. Thank you very much, and may we hand over to you for responses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, I'll ask my colleague to assist me in some areas where he had more experience. Starting with Mr. Rabi, the question was, are they, I should give examples of policies, areas where policy deficiencies. I was just thinking quickly at the top of my head. We didn't have a training policy that's understandable that can be applied consistently within the company. So those are, I'm just making examples. That's one of the policies we're looking at. Right now we're operating in a. Secondly, right now we're operating in an open plan environment. And there are areas where, you know, open plan has got its own challenges. I was with IDC, we had offices, and we moved to open plan. When you move to open plan, you find you have to control the noise level, you have to control your activities and all that, but some of them didn't have that. So those are some of the policies we're developing to make sure that those are the areas where say there are inefficiencies. Of course, or there are no policies are not existent. I'm just thinking about these two as an example. But there are other areas where, or there are other policies that exist, but we need to refine them. With like even if one can go down to the dress policy, how we dress. And in some cases, I didn't quite like what people were, what did we look like, you know, because how you look like also sends a certain message. So those are some of the areas that, you know, that we're looking at. As far as the Kenyan and other African experience is concerned, I'm very desirous to learn about those economies, to understand how they made it, because it is true that it is very important for us in this country to make sure that microfinance is microfinance industry is developed to a much, much bigger extent than it is now. Unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to discuss with the previous leadership. But for me, it is one of the projects that I've just started working on to do that comparison. So I should understand why do others make it better. In South America as well, I think it's Peru, they're doing much better than everybody else. And one needs to pull all of these areas and read about all of these areas, look at how they do it better and try to implement it here, because truly, truly, it is much needed here. I think my heart always goes out for people who are sitting out there and struggling to make ends meet when we have the means, as you know, as some of we have the means that have been provided by government to make sure that those people's lives are changed for the better. So yes, I think we need to do that research and make sure that we develop this thing, even in the new institution, to make sure that we develop microfinance to a better level. This is why we are protective about this, I must say, Madam Chair. When we engage with the steering committee of the new that's driving the measure, sometimes there are some heated exchanges, because we're trying to protect this thing. We're saying we are not going to allow, we should not allow the role that Samaf is playing in the economy of this country to be undermined by the nation. So I think I take the point there very, very much. We need to do a proper study to understand what the how we can improve on this one. The sad part is that it is microfinance as an industry is very new in this country, comparatively. It is new, so there are challenges both from SAMAF and from the institutions that we serve. So we need to find a way to make sure that those challenges are done away with. I think this also addresses one of the questions that was asked about the interest rates. I think that this is Madam Chair that asked the question about interest rates. There are some FIs that charge 40% interest. That's a big concern. Unfortunately, I don't think there has been enough study done. There's enough study done here to understand or to unpack these charges and to make sure that the interest charged to the end user at the end of the day is affordable. So this is really one of the areas we're looking at very seriously, and I hope that in the near future, well, not in the reasonable future, medium future, will come with something that, you know, that can assist in this area. Mr. Kobaza. His question was, what are the reasons for improvement in approved funding? The reasons we mentioned earlier are really, the major reason is really the improvement in turnaround time, because that created capacity for us to be able to work with more applications or more financial institutions such that we could do the approval. And of course also the staff in regional offices, I must say, is very positive about what they're doing, and they took the challenge of improving on turnaround time very positively, and that their positive attitude has actually resulted in us going through and approving more funding in the previous year. I will ask you, should we wait for...
No, go ahead. He raised the issue of why there was this condonation by PDG. The reason why there was a condonation by the DG is that some have engaged in the services of EdTech. They were the only sole service provider to especially in the loan finance system, which is called ECPEC. So it took more time to collect the data so that the system could start to be implemented. That is why there has been an overrun which DG has to condone. It could be perhaps the data was not available as is required by the service provider. It could also be perhaps inefficiencies on our side. But the fact of the matter was that the implementation of the APEX system took long.
Okay. All right. The question of combining the Free State Office and the Northern Cape Office, I think maybe I should have put it more correctly. We're not talking about closing the one office, but we're just talking about combined at management level, because we have one manager in Free State. We don't have a manager in Northern Cape, but we think that if we, rather than having a manager in Northern Cape, maybe we'd have one manager in running the two offices and have another outreach coordinator in Northern Cape. So in other words, it's just at management level. It's not that we're going to close off one office. but we're actually going to capacitate it with a runner rather than a manager. So the outreach would actually be higher, as I would imagine, would actually be better because, you know, sorry, there'll be an extra outreach coordinator.
I think, Baba Mamatel, the problem is that you did not give us how many runners per province.
Yes.
You just said you've got offices. Now you come with this idea of combining without telling us per office how many runners, because the important thing are the runners.
Yes.
Because we don't know these managers, what are they doing. I'll give you an example that in KwaZulu-Natal, I managed to look for them, particularly Samaf, Kula, and Sida. They did not know each other. But I managed to call them, looking for them. They are gone. The other one is Newcastle, Peter Maristet, Bepet. Then I called them, when they were sitting together, they did not know. They did not even know the office in Peter Maristet, the MEC, or local, on economic development. They did not know. Then I said, but how do you work? And that's why I think if you can, maybe the question is intending to reveal that what are they doing, these managers at these offices? How many runners? Because I remember the other day, I mean, for the first time when we met, we even suggested, why don't we have people riding bicycles going to the end users? But it, we have never got a feedback.
I was trying to say how did that question came about?
I think, you know, we should have mentioned, maybe in future we'll mention how many outreach coordinators we have in the province. But I think it is important for me at least, or for us, we're looking at the sum of models, and we're saying as we prepare to get to study the models of other economies, and we're saying maybe, you know, we might get to a point where some of model is tweaked a little bit, hopefully for the better. So maybe the outreach coordinators, as we have them, would maybe do things slightly differently. But let's come back to the committee about that in future. The other question was about the measure, saying that there was other companies that came here, I think IDC, that gave the assurance that there won't be any job losses. That is true. We also communicated that message to some throughout, almost regularly and daily. But the challenge that creates the uncertainty is that people are saying, look, I'm sitting here now as in a position X. What will be my position going forward? Because particularly for the support staff, if you have a IT manager, for instance, Samav has an IT manager, Kula has an IT manager. So in the one combined entity, we're gonna need only one IT manager. The question then is, what will my role be as another IT manager? Possibly would be the deputy of another, but the uncertainty is, will I be the one who's going to head IT, or I'm going to report to the other one? That is the uncertainty we're talking about. What we'll do is, the question from Babunduli was, are we following the mandate in terms of looking at rural areas urban areas and peri-urban areas. Babuntuli actually made an example of Limpopo and wants to know why Limpopo is seems to be performing and compared to other provinces. Fortunately, Patrick was the regional manager of Limpopo, and I'm surely can pass this question over to him. He will be much better positioned to explain.
But Chair, that was the second part. The first one is the money.
The second part. The first one is the mandate, the urban versus the rural. I'm saying we are supposed to see Northern Cape leading, KwaZulu-Natal leading, all these provinces which are rural. But it's not. That's why I was asking about the mandate. That's the second part of the Limpopo one. If you can take it, the first one.
As far as the first one is concerned, Madam Chair, we are doing everything in our power to follow the mandate. Our products are structured in such a way they benefit people in the rural areas, peri-urban areas, but also one should be mindful of the fact that we do have areas like squatter camps and even in urban areas. So that those are the areas we concentrating on. In our performance highlights, we indicated here that 80% of loans by FIs to end users were in rural communities. So we provided funding to these FIs for them to fund in rural communities. And 95% were micro enterprise loans. So this clearly says 80% of the funding that we provided ended up in rural areas, which is a good thing. This is what it's standing for.
But I think also in your report you indicated in terms of your how you are situated in the whole country, you find that your existence mostly in the Western Cape, in Gauteng, in Limpopo. Yes, Limpopo is mostly rural, but then it then brings in the question of your definition of a rural area, if we were to go with what you're saying now. That's why I asked it later on the question around the impact. How do you measure your impact? Because to us it's very important because of the understanding of the mandate, as also explained by the Deputy Minister here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have to clarify the fact that even if it looks like Gauteng is performing very well, the institutions which are based in Gauteng, they operate in the rural areas. In the sense that you find that you have an organization like Marang Financial Services Pty Limited, they do not operate their business in Gauteng. That is why you see the percentage is quite high, or to 80%, because they are spread all over the provinces. That is what I just wanted to clarify. With regard to the issue of Limpopo,
if a stock fell or newly established co-op would come to you from, let's say, Mpumalanga, requiring your services, would you be able to assist them freely without even looking at other RFIs, for instance, that are spread in other provinces? Because the reason we are saying this is because Gauteng intermediaries and FSCs would obviously dominate because they have everything within their exposure in terms of technology, in terms of resource, other related resources. And if you were to compete, Gauteng and rural areas, I mean, obviously Gauteng would expand much more easier than the ones in the rural areas. That's why it's very important that, because it's unfair, Gauteng also benefits from Okula, benefits from, in terms of land development. There's readily available infrastructure for them to really can do business. Here we're talking about that poor person who depends on the remittances from somebody who's working in Gauteng or Western Cape or wherever. That's the end beneficiary that we're talking about. I think that's where the mandate issue comes in, that are we looking carefully and realistically at our mandate with an intention of refocusing our efforts to the right market that we're supposed to be focusing on.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. I think what is currently happening is that if you look at the industry in South Africa, we only have three big MFIs, which are in the whole country. But this other one is in the rural area, and it's doing very well in Limpopo. But when it comes to the focus, because we know that these three big institutions are covering almost the entire country, our focus is on facilitating the establishment of financial services cooperatives. If a cooperative comes from any village to our offices, we have to assist them. But the issue here is there are a number of issues that you raised in your questions. There are issues of requirements, criteria. When do you qualify? So we had all these institutions from the beginning. We take them through to Cipro so that they are registered. And once that has been done, we automatically start to do business with them. At the moment, as Mr. Mamatela has indicated, we still have this function of regulations, which function will soon be going to CBDA. It's an added advantage now because we can regulate these institutions and finally register them with Kula and still fund them. That is our focus. Thank you.
I'm not sure whether you really understand the concern of the committee also. I do understand what you're saying, but you know, the issue around the mandate is very, very important. What we talked about earlier on, I think you were there, and that you were there when we raised our concern of your spread. The reason why we're raising that concern is because of what we saw on the ground going out. That's why I raised the issues of inconsistencies. Because you're saying you're applying, but at the same time, when you go down there, I still say there are RFCs that are not favored by those MRIs because of somebody who has an interest, perhaps, and who feels threatened by the existence of, you know, this particular RFC. And how do you operate in such a... Because these people are really dependent and they don't know any MFIs, I mean, sorry. They don't know anybody, they know SAMAF. And they will always point to SAMAF to say, SAMAF is the one that is not doing their job. And that is why we're asking, how best do you make, because to make sure that you reach out to those people. Because you're saying you are training them, you are taking them to Cipro for registration. I want to tell you and contest what you are saying by saying that that's not what is happening on the ground. People are not being assisted readily, like, you know, they're supposed to be assisted. They are made to wait long for this kind of services. Or they are being tricked sometimes. Of, we know of one, for instance, where we went to, we found that the farmer's employee is the one who dictates as to what should happen. Because he happens to know somebody there, and then unless that somebody is doing, you know, as he wants, he's not going to consider that. And to me, it was very much unfair, because your approval is based on a liking or disliking of an individual who's seated somewhere who doesn't understand the plight of those people, or he might be understanding, but he's looking or she's looking inward. And therefore, that's why we were talking also of regulations. You're saying you are regulating, but at the end of the day, how to ensure that people are not being disadvantaged? They get what they're supposed to be getting. And that's why when you came, we specifically asked that question and requested that you go and look at that so that you can begin to unblock these difficulties that are experienced by our people there. So this money is meant for them, not for some of employees, not for the, you say, the MFIs. Yes. So I really, there I think the committee would like to see progress. And if you can report to us to show that you went down, you checked on those people, you understood, we even gave you the names, because we were just fresh from that those visits. We gave you the names of those FSCs that wanted to, especially the one of Kwamakri. Yes, it was Kwamakri, Newcastle. We were expecting you to say to us today, this is, we went to Kwamakri, we followed up this matter, and this is where we're standing now with them. Because we don't want them to say, oh, politicians come here and it's worthless, because whatever they're saying, they're promising is not done. We were there with official regional officials of the SAMAF, but if nothing happens, it means we are toothless, like many people would like to say. And if we come, we recommend so nicely to you to say, this is what you need to do to help our people, especially with this one, with, you know, with SAMAF. That we get very agitated, because it's supposed to target the poorest of the poor. And we cannot play with the plight of the people like that. That's why we want you to really take this very seriously. You know, the note that we talk, you know, the way we express ourselves, or you can hear me that I'm very agitated when it comes to this.
I think, Madam Chair, let me put it on record that we hear you loud and clear, and we take this very seriously. I promise that when you do come later, this issue has been addressed. Definitely, we'll have some sort of results to show. This is what you've done. We'll show. This is what you've done. As far as Kwamakri is concerned, fortunately we've done some work on it. We are already dispersed. We have already dispersed, I think, with Kwamakri. Some amount. So it's part of one. It happened this year, unfortunately, not included in this, the previous financial period that we're talking about.
Oh, we find this in the quarterly report. Okay.
Yes, it's already there.
I think it's comforting to hear that there's something that you've done according to
me. And on that, even the issue you raised of Newcastle, I personally went there. I met Mr. Mangete and some other board members. We were trying to resolve the issues. We have also disbursed to them a certain amount of money, I think, last quarter or this quarter. Yeah.
We will follow up on this, sir. On this matter. And the women in Ekurhuleni, Durban, the very successful women, very enthusiastic. Also, I just we want progress on that.
Madam Chair, when you spoke to the chairperson, she said she's going to notify the portfolio committee that we've dispersed, and she was very happy. We viewed the CETA office. I'm actually surprised why she hasn't communicated that information. She's very happy. She's actually, we went to see her about 1.5 months ago or something. She even indicated that she's been approached, she's now being approached, she's been torn apart by everybody in KZN. You know, they wanted to assist them to develop to where she is now. So we are looking at how we can roll out that program with her. So that we've good news to tell about it.
The kind of reporting we want. It shows us that at least you understand what we cry and howl about.
We move on to debate on the issue of the proposed performance. You wanted the clarification. Rule and fact. Okay. The unfortunate part of our model is that we are not doing it direct. We are doing it through FI, financial intermediaries. And I think it is a challenge. So the impact on our model, we're looking at the number of more people who have been assisted by those financial intermediaries, specifically on the money that was funded to that organization by SAMAP. We do not look at the holistic picture. We only concentrate on our fund. In fact, when we give them loan, we inform them to ring fence our funding so that we will be able to identify it. There is an impact because if you look at some other areas, if you have ever been in an area called Chakuma, in towards Toyano, there is a place where people are standing for 24 hours nonstop. Or if you go there, Chakuma. Yes, Chakuma. They're selling fruits to the market. You go there transport long, they're busy, and the kids are going to university from those things that they're selling there. So there is an impact. The only problem is that we have been working on developing a tool so that we could be able to measure the impact. It's not easy, as I'm saying, because we are not directly giving the money to the end users. We are doing it through the intermediary. That is our challenge. Our target is the end user. Through the financial intermediary.
The target, Mr. Nduli, is the end user. We're providing wholesale funding. We're providing wholesale funding for all lending to end users. The target is not the intermediary. It is the end user that we're interested in.
But you're not lending directly.
No.
Yes. So then there comes your responsibility to monitor those middle people. Because I think that's where I think you are lacking. Monitor them, check whether they are working according to your requirements, so that at the end of the day, the end user or beneficiary end up getting what is true to him or her. Maybe you need also to develop a working tool for the regions, so that they are able to do that and help you in reporting. I heard the department, they have a reporting, a monitoring and evaluation tool. Maybe that can also assist you, because it will you'll just map the results on that tool. That's all. Maybe now in our next engagement you'll be able to give us good news to that regard. Yeah, I think they committed to that they're going to look into it.
Yes, Madam Chair, we certainly. What we are working on that thing, by the way, as we're speaking now. That tool that the EDD is reporting on is appropriate for the likes of IDC. You know, it's the information they extract is for us. It doesn't actually say much about what we're doing. So we said to them, we are going to come with our key performance areas, and also one of the major thing is the impact. We want to, in that tool, in that reporting tool, as I said, you know, maybe deviation, no, not the right way, but our reporting will differ slightly with the other institutions, because ours should really say much about the impact we're doing on the ground. And that's what we're trying to build at the moment.
Incentives that Babantul has raised to stock fairs, what are the incentives available? We have, I think it's after you have engaged us, we developed a product where we are saying that if there are, say, 30 people who could form a stock fair, they qualify to get an amount of 250,000. We took your recommendations into consideration, where you raised an issue of saying, why don't you give these people a small amount so that they could start on learning among themselves. We have done that. We provide them with 250 for capacity building, which will help them to pay their employees, buy the computers and the stationaries, as well as furniture. And then we put aside an amount of 50,000 to say to them, this is your incentive to help you to grow so that you could be able to reach a level of a financial services cooperative. This 50,000 is non-refundable. It's non-repayable. They don't have to pay it back. But there is a condition. Before we give the 50,000, because we are aware that they do not have the knowledge and experience with regards to on lending. We say, okay, we give you the 50,000. Condition number one, we will first capacitate you on the lending methodologies, and thereafter we disburse the 50,000. There was another question. From Valentin, do you have community outreach?
The 250 doesn't include capacity building on others, like financial management, like because they're working as groups, personality, what do you call it? Come again? No. Conflict management skills. The other one would be general management and governance issues. Is it part of, or is it only the 50,000 where you're giving them on lending?
It is only on the 50,000 which is not paid back, where we are giving them on lending. But we also provide other trainings, like what you are raising. The governance issues, financial management issues, we provide those trainings separately. Yes.
The
outreach issue.
I
want to raise the issue of community outreach. It is true that we have to go out and do community outreach. We have to visit all the municipalities. We have to work with the municipalities, LEDs. We have to work with the provincial government. In fact, if you look what happened in Limpopo, there is a national quota. These institutions which are have national footprint, they have their own quota, where they meet with the provincial structures to look at the gaps which we could together address. So you find sometimes these other institutions are having their own outreach. You piggyback on those outreach programs and go and talk about your institutions. So there is a difficulty. If you look at a province like KwaZulu-Natal, I'm just giving an example. I think it's quite a big province. And we are not structured like an institution which looks like CEDA. CEDA is represented in all the district municipalities, and it becomes very, very easy for them to penetrate the market, their market. So with us, if you look, I've seen it when I was in KZN the other day. For a person to drive to Newcastle from Tequini, I think it's quite far.
400.
Yeah, about 400. So perhaps the problem is the way in which our structure looks like. And perhaps if we could be given an opportunity in the new entity so that the structure is spread into districts, the outreach will be very, very strong.
Okay, I think there are two more issues that the Madam Chair raised. One being material losses that amount to 1 million, if this is what I think that's it on page 18. That resulted as a because of a write-off. The harsh reality is that the area we're operating in is high risk. I think we're always going to have issues, we're always going to have write-offs. Because, you know, apart from the grant funding that we provide, the loan funding that we provide is not secured, it's unsecured. You know, there's nothing really. There's no security that one can get from the type of institutions that we're funding, but we have to fund them, and we have to try and apply some prudent measures to make sure we get our money back. But you know, we should accept that there will be write-offs. Simply because of the high risk that we operating in. And I think, you know, yes, I propose, you know, we should accept that we will have the write-offs, you know, every year.
Yes, we understand, but why is it an irregular, is it classified under irregular activities by the DHA?
I think if it's the one on page 18, Madam Chair, it's not the irregular one.
It is a material loss.
Yes.
Yes.
It doesn't mean it's not irregular.
Oh,
yes.
It's a material loss.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But you do have wasteful expenditure, the computer loss. There's no remedial goal. Taken in that regard.
Yeah.
And you're not also telling us in terms of the material losses as to what actions did you take before you wrote it off. Because it's important that we understand this thing. Because while we understand that it's a normal practice to write off loans, but there must be substantial reasons why. So that it's not taken as a normal practice within institutions to do that.
It is through Madam Chair, our policies and procedures are such that we make sure that we don't write off anything. Or we try to make sure we write off to a minimum extent. And we tried a legal action against these write offs, but the institutions just don't exist anymore. So it's very difficult. I think we were going to spend more money in the lawyers, with the lawyers, trying to chase something that doesn't exist anymore. So,
but they attach people's houses. I mean, when they finance these end users, they really, one of their criteria for funding is that they go to your house, they check how many things how much you own, for instance, your property, your assets, other assets, movable or removable, and then if you default, they attach. But what happens to your case? Most of them, they put everything under. I think the law was addressing this issue around what is it when you put your property under. A trust, under trust, so that you can't access it. But I think you must also work on measures. But they do profit a lot, this MFIs. They do profit a lot. And we can't be funding people to disappear, whereas with the end users, they do something else. And you can't do the same with them. That's why I'm saying it shouldn't be taken as a normal practice. I mean, when I look at the previous, you lost something like 7 million, more than 7 million, which was too much. Yes, last year it was quite minimal, 1 point something, but still, it's a lot of money to that poor person who doesn't have anything.
Since I was saying, if you look at it, they foreclose or they underwrite to the intermediaries, not to the end use. So you see, that's why I was saying, seemingly the scheme is just to uplift the SC. Seemingly, our job is just to uplift those people. We don't care about the end user, because whatever we do, when we underwrite, it's for them. But we don't know what means unborn to the end user. Maybe they've taken their houses, you don't know. You just look at these intermediaries and you say, we underwrite. We don't. Maybe they're still continuing collecting the money from the end user. So that's what I'm saying. That's what I've observed when we're going around. Say, no, the target here is these people. They are driving beautiful cars, they've got this, but nobody cares about the one who's selling, smiling on the street.
Through you, Madam Chair, I just want to clarify the issue of financial services cooperatives. With financial service cooperatives, if it goes under for all the members, because the members are the ones that forms that institution. The problem comes in respect of a microfinance institution. If it goes under, it goes under for a few people, because it is owned by, say, directors who could move at 4 or 5. So with our target market when it comes to financial services, it's very much relevant, because those are the members who form that institution, who participate as a cooperative. Thank you.
And the MFIs, we mentioned there's three big ones in the country. So we're looking at cooperatives. We're looking at stock cells that can be upgraded to be cooperatives that we can fund them. That's what we're looking at.
What I'm trying to say, of which you're saying you have no other way except the MFIs, isn't it? Is that true, what I'm saying? I just want to understand the relationship that you are trying to explain between yourself, MFIs, FSCs, and their beneficiaries.
What I'm trying to say, Madam Chair, is that with FSCs, an FSC is made up of members, and if we fund an FSC, it means we have funded all the members.
Yes, that's why I was talking about the Cooperative Act, because it then guides you on what to do in terms of the formation of the cooperative. Because stage one, they don't have members, to be honest, because they are still those people. And then the second phase, they increase, and then they have membership, and they are funded according to the size of the membership. That's what the act says. And then phase three, they can now qualify perhaps for MRIs. MFIs, am I correct?
No, they remain an MFC. They don't
remain level 2 FSC. But at what stage do they qualify for MFI?
They don't read that.
But can they apply to be an MFI at some stage?
No.
Because they have all the qualifications.
No. Let me give
what governs MFIs? Maybe that would help us understand.
MFIs are governed through Companies Act. They are registered in terms of the Companies Act, and then the FSCs are registered in terms of the Cooperatives Act. That's the difference.
Don't lose the question, the essence of the question. The essence of the question is to help uplift those cooperatives. Let's not use the FSC what cooperatives, because the end users of cooperatives, at the end of the day, they become members of those FSCs. But with MFIs, because that's where we are complaining a lot, these MFIs are making a lot of money out of, you know, these people. Because MFIs don't just fund or finance FSCs, they finance even the end user. And that's where we are complaining, because a woman who wants to sell makwinya in a corner somewhere would want to borrow 2,000 rand for a start, or 1,000 rand to establish her business. And if she's borrowed 2,000 rand with an interest of 30%, how do you expect that woman to really survive? You can't. I mean, this is way above even the normal interest rates of the commercial banks. So that is what is the essence of the question that Wabuntul is following on. So that's why he's asking, who is your target market? Who is your target actually as SAMAF? Is it to enrich the MFIs, or is it to make this cooperative function and get elevated to the MFI position at some stage together with their members? Wherein they are going to be having the board of directors also among themselves and be able to function, you know. Because we want to know, because they at some stage, because going through levels, they gain experience through that. Will they remain FSC with the SAMA forever? How do they see themselves, you know, being elevated up to that level? Well, some of them would want to own the village banks, and how do they go about doing that? If really the people down there, they're still suffering the way they're suffering. I think this is a serious question. We understand you are doing your business in relation to what your mandate says, but can't you eliminate this level, the MFI level, and hand it over to Kula? Because in as far as I'm concerned, they belong there because they have expertise, they have, you know, they can compete at that level with the medium enterprises and some of the small enterprises. Why do we really finance them at the expense of the target of where, that of summer? Maybe that's the questions we need to be asking, because it will also give us an indication as to when we discuss with the issue of the measure with the department as to what influence do we make in the whole thing.
I think the end user is actually the initiator of SAMA, because it is because of their situation that you ended up using SAMA.
Mm-hmm.
Hence this dedication to them.
Madam Chair, the role of SAMA, among others, as we mentioned earlier, is to be a catalyst to in development of the microfinance industry in the country. So we have to play a role in empowering these institutions that provide funding to the unfundable. They happen to be MFIs. Yes. Unfortunately, we are compromised. We have these are the institutions, the only institutions we can use, who will fund those of us who cannot be funded by commercial banks. And the second part then is we funding cooperatives. Now, cooperatives is more, I'll call them cooperatives, it's an emphasis. It's more like we're funding members directly, because their organization or theirs that we're funding, they own. So the funding is going to come from their own organization to fund them. Are you with me? They own this FSC. We provide funding to the FSC. The FSC then provides funding to the members. They provide loans to the members. That one is...
But then, I want to differ with you there. Because the criteria to finance FSC, one, they must have saved at least 100,000. And that's not helping people. Because, yes, you're encouraging the FSCs, cooperatives, to be formed. But at the end of the day, these cooperatives are forced to be formed in those rural areas because they want financing. Let's say they can't afford 100,000 according to the Cooperatives Act. What are we saying? Is it a correct thing? Because that's why I'm saying I differ with you there, because it's something that is existing. They can do even without you. They can still go to the commercial banks and survive because they're used to. You know that some commercial banks do have a facility for them or facilities, and they even help them better. So if, for instance, a cooperative is formed and they don't have at least 100,000 in their banks, they are not able to be funded. That's why we had a situation in the Newcastle. That's why we had a situation in the Newcastle, because some of us were saying you don't meet the requirements, and therefore we are not going to be able to finance you. You don't meet the requirement of having so many people. For instance, a stock fair is a stock fair. It can have 7 people. And those 7 people might not be able to recruit because they don't have financial means to go out and recruit other people. Or they don't have the necessary stature to go and find and recruit other people. So the model itself, I find it very insufficient, because it's only based on the Cooperative Act that is so prescriptive in such a way that it's also restrictive. Can you respond to that?
I would just to clarify, just by making another example, what we found here in Gugulethu. We found there that there is an FSC which is dispersing money. But we went further to the township there. Safito Mamu Kaisa, Amape, whatever, underwent CM Kwakwe. He's not a member of the FSC. Uthi uwabole ku 1,200 to buy this old second-hand thing. She's selling there. Let me ask him, how do you pay? Said, every Friday, the man will come from the SSC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to collect this money. Then I just said, but how do you make profit? Say, hey, I survive, my child. I'm also selling I'm a smile. Then that you know we're asking ourselves, is this person being assisted? This person who's selling on the pavement. Because in Jalo Friday, it's not it's not a member of the board, it's just taking the money there with a peg. Then the next Friday, the man is coming to collect.
I think these are very pertinent issues. And also, that's why I was saying, clarify yourself. I'm different because FSC, Cooperative Act, the way it prescribes, Western Cape doesn't comply. All the FSCs that you visited in Western Cape don't comply. At least KwaZulu-Natal. Because really, those FSCs, they are abomashonisa, that's all. And are we really promoting abomashonisa? So I think these are the things that are very problematic. So I'm saying, Mamatel, I'm differing with you because I went through, you know, this thing made me to go through that act, the Cooperative Act, just to get an understanding of what's going on. And that's what I was saying earlier on the inconsistencies in applying this, your mandate.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I concur with what Avantuli say. If things like those are happening, those institutions should be reported because they are in violation with the Act. Okay. Yeah, and but the other thing, when I come back to your issue, in terms of our qualifying criteria, we have tried our level best to reduce a lot of requirements when it comes to FSCs. An entry level FSC, when it needs funding from SAMAF, the savings that we require, they should have put in the bank. It's 10,000 rand.
You have that stipulated somewhere?
Yes.
Where?
In our product sheet.
It's just a product sheet?
Yes. And they.
But what happens to those who refer them to Corps Act? Because you might be doing that somewhere, but somewhere you might not be doing that. Because I also heard in Gauteng that you are applying that. But in the rural areas, that's not what is being applied. And I'm worried because the abuse, that's where the abuse is. In Gauteng, the lady was very clear in explaining how they're working. They're doing very well because they've managed to do what you're saying. But that's why I'm worried. It's not that I don't have this information. I'm worried about the inconsistencies. You can't be coming from the same institution. Somebody else somewhere is applying something else. Somebody else somewhere is doing something else. It cannot be. The message to the consumer should be the same. So that if I want, I have to choose what I want. I don't have to be 7 or 10 or what for me to want to qualify. Because there are some people who can't work within groups. It's a fact. So I think that message needs to be taken to all the people in the same manner, in the same way, so that people are able to choose. That's what I was referring to in terms of inconsistencies. That's why I'm saying then, help us to get that information so that you are able then to talk to people properly. Yes. Under which circumstances do we refer people to the Corps Act? Under which circumstances do we apply our own homegrown, you know, requirements?
This is it's a difficult one. If it's happening, it's very embarrassing, I must say. That inconsistency, Madam Chair. I think maybe what I should propose is, let us in the quarterly or whatever, let us communicate this, like the product sheet, that information to the committee. So, you know, would have a view of how this thing works. And at the same time, you know, I must say that this model is not really perfect. I don't think it's very perfect. This is why it is imperative on us to go and look at best practices elsewhere and try to improve this model. I do accept it's not perfect. But, you know, the embarrassing part is if it's whatever rules and laws we have, if they're applied inconsistently, then that one is a problem. It's an issue of policy and whatever. I think let's take note of that and look at it very seriously. At least with FSCs, we should be able to monitor them easily. That the cooperatives, we should be able to police them. So those I think we can maybe the we still have a headache with MFIs. We still have a headache with that. But maybe let's eat the elephant, you know, piece by piece. Let's do this one, get it done perfectly, and then, you know, see how we can handle this other one, which in any event we may want to get out of. You know, it's not a big focus area anyway.
Yeah, we might seem very critical, but you know, when it comes to this issue, because they confront us, because we are there at the coal face at the end of the day, and you know, when you talk some of this, not of help, what's the use? And you know, when you talk to people and they say that, they automatically disempower you, because here you come, you come with a product that it was specifically crafted for them, but then they say to you, doesn't work. And I mean, and they'll tell you, they'll give you references, we went there, nothing. And that's why we're saying, have a presence everywhere, especially where you were actually established to service. Mamso Tetsia, and
you know, at all times when we do oversight, we first communicate with yourself, and in your presence, sometimes just a talk to people, but you manage to get this information that she's referring to. Maybe in future we have to visit them unannounced. You know, what we've seen really is not what we are here for. We are here to represent them, but it's like we are misrepresenting them. And come election time, they'll be talking to these things, and we cannot point fingers. It's not us, it's them. You know, we just have to give answers. And when you say capacity building, you actually ask yourself who's been capacitated if we still have such a situation. And spending money on that, you know, for people to be able to run their businesses. And when we talk about surplus, again, it must be surplus versus unsuccessful applicants. that we have so many people being unsuccessful, but we still have Kepler.
Can I just...
To add on, it's a contingency fund. Mm-hmm. And contingency funds are meant for unforeseen circumstances. And if we have that and we call it a surplus, it's not correct. Because such contingency funds are put aside for that purpose, and if not utilized for the whole year, then it's either they serve as a variance for the coming financial year, or they are taken back to, or through the request of treasurer, of course. They are put as variances if approved, or they taken back. But under the circumstances where you operating, I think there are a lot of contingencies that you can perhaps respond to. Please, we want you to use the money that you are given. So that our people are able to benefit.
Yes, Madam Chair, it is true. The surplus it looks nice, you know, for accounting, you see surplus, but this is not really a surplus. This is not really, it should not be a surplus. So we are painfully aware of that, and we're trying very hard to make sure we utilize this money for those people that really need this funding. This is why we have to review our criteria and all those things to make sure that if we have to soften them up a little, maybe if that's what is required in the market, maybe we should take a relook at that and see if we can just to make sure that we don't have a huge surplus, because this is not we're not so much in the profit making as we are in providing a service. Yeah. You know, maybe can I ask a assistance here, Madam Chair, about those provinces or the areas where there was inconsistency of application of the rules? Maybe we, you know, if we can have, if it's possible, you know, to be, to direct us, so we should take action on them.
Thank you. I think that Tematoma would know, because we did report immediately when we came back. We had an interaction with the summer. I think we were considered in the last quarter report, if I'm not mistaken. We did indicate to you that these are the inconsistencies that we found. We saw you noting, and Mr. Naidu noting them, and we took it that you are really working on these things. And we were very specific then, because this was very fresh. But we could make them available again if you so wish. So that you are able to assist. You know, it was painful to see that woman and women. In my mind, I have the faces of those women in Khayelitsha, mm-hmm. and the woman in Lang. That were really to me. I thought these are people who are just being exploited. Okay. Yeah, but we will give you further details of such. We haven't visited all the provinces in as far as this is concerned, but we are intending to look further into this, just to check whether there are any improvements. And perhaps also from our side, Gwebu, we need to write back to these people, just to check whether they've been attended to, and if there are any other areas, because it might not happen that within this 5-year term that we visit them again. But at least just to get from them whether there's any feedback. Tatematuma, do you want to come here? Okay. Dr. Mamatela?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm really interested in this one. You know, I'll get information from Matoma, Mr. Matoma. And it's a sad day. We don't want things like this, especially for those of us who are less fortunate. And, you know, given the government has created this vehicle to assist them. So I promise I'll do everything in my mind to attend to those issues.
Thank you. Anything from the members, okay? And Dr. Kwabasa, Mem Sotetsi, and Mem Babuntuli. As a round off, please.
Yeah, Chair, I'm not sure whether I'm now talking to issues that might have been touched on page 79 of the book. Yes. Starting from just about the beginning, if you look at consulting fees, the 2.3 million consulting fees, there is further down other consulting fees. If one could get an explanation, what are you consulting on these things? That's number one. Number two, there's money paid for external audit, which is understandable, although it looks quite high. But you also have internal audit remuneration amounting to 754,000 and so on and so on. My question is, if you're dealing with internal audit, are you not using somebody who is, you know, paid to do that work because it is part of his or her job description? Why do you have extra pay for somebody who is internal? My understanding is you're talking about somebody who is part of your established, your human resource. The travel and subsistence looks quite high. Some explanation there, and then other expenses which are not explained what they are. That one just a little over 1 million rand. If we could have further explanation of that, the amount seem somewhat big, Chairperson, and a little bit of duplication so far as consulting fees and the audit. Thank you, Chair.
Next,
we think alike in this committee. Our first thing to remind you that we didn't exhaust the HR issues in the same case. I cannot repeat. We have the audit and risk committee fees. That how come you have such a situation when we have this audit and risk committee fees that were paid? What risk assessment were these people doing? And the consulting fees already alluded to, I'll try to keep them. And then on personal expenses, we have an amount that is inclusive, but on page 78, it indicates performance bonuses. I'm not sure what does it mean. I mean, having such a situation and talk about performance bonus, if one of them performance evaluation or performance bonus, what does it mean? If people have to be paid and we have this kind of situation. If we can also get that list of employees with the post level and the amount of relation and the amount of page 78 and 79 of the master copies. The post level of those people who got their performance bonus. domestic breakdown. And here on we also have training and development. We spend so much money training managers on and on trainable. And we have travel and subsistence. Also, the amount is just inclusive. If we can get a breakdown of where did people travel to, how much they spent, and what was the reason for the trips, and the dates as well. So we can check if people spend more time traveling than doing their work.
Sorry, I said
seven.
Page 61 is 79, I'm sorry.
No, you did say 79. Yeah. Thank you.
Welcome. I would like to emphasize that if you can correct this interest charge to the end users to be uniform. Secondly, maybe you would be assisted once this cooler direct is in operation. Let's have a look at that, whether we can use cooler to disperse money. I mean, and the mentors or the capacity, it's sometimes we find that when you talk about the capacity, you just mentor these FSCs. Then you find that the end user, because now the end user is somebody who happens to go, you find that he or she knows nothing about anything. Does not know about farmers. They're hearing for the first time, and when he can see several farmers in the street, oh, and there's farmers behind this one. And then it's very embarrassing, but you know, it's too much government. So, don't check who farmers are as well as well, who want to know my SSC. Lastly, Chair, I think we have emphasized this uniformity. Consistency of operator. KwaZulu Natal, particularly in Umlaas, there is a, I'll call it a, bahlanganile banikezwe imali to give up the FSC. Banikwe imali, it's about 1 million by the premier. To use this money, babbling is a night. Then you have got clients about Ukona Bahaba, they collect. But when you check it, what is it? Summers, is it Kula? Who's doing these things? I'm talking and I did ask Umaral, does he know about that transaction? What is Ranji? I heard Utina Timaria, he was what? I was the idea to my band, not my veteran. So it's very embarrassing. That is the day, particularly with the provinces. If you can check your people at a provincial, these managers, do they touch base with economic development at a provincial level? Because our constituency is the same. We can be here in the national, but in the constituency, is that one for the province? So how come that we don't know each other, but we are working on the same constituency? So it means that we need to have a coordinated effort to say, you know, it is a national party. The province has to know it. National is doing this. Umaspala do not know Samas in the mesh. So what Samas is doing, I was asking their strategy at the mesh. I was saying, well, who's Samas? No, there's Samas from that to does it work? You know, it's a marathon. If you can be able to do good, you know, search.
Thanks.
Under consulting fees, we have here information technology and earlier on, one of the reasons why people are resigning was that an example of two people doing IT, but here we have it under consulting fees. It means the person was not fully employed to do that, but it was under consulting.
Well, other consulting fees. Sorry, I was not prepared for that one, Madam Chair. I can only go back and investigate and come with an answer.
You are allowed to do so.
Internal and external audit. The company, like some of, like any other, like for all most financial institutions, you should ideally have a internal audit unit that oversees the financial department. We actually don't have a internal finance as a unit because of the size, but we outsource that to internal auditors to Gobodo. They are internal auditors. They do internal audit, but they are external. I don't know if it's clear. They are external, but we must remember the internal audit function and external audit function is slightly different. So they do the internal audit function, but they are outsourced.
Internal audit audit unit.
Yeah.
You have audit committee. Can you clarify the difference between the two? Which one do you have as some of under that the service that you get?
We have Gobodo who does the internal audit function for us. But we also have the audit committee that sits and overlooks, you know, at the high level, overlooks the functions, what we do, as well as to go through the reports that Gobodo would be submitting.
So Gobodo reports to the audit committee.
Audit committee, yes.
And the acting CEO.
Well, dotted line, but really they report to
But the role, the function of the internal audit unit is to advise the acting CEO as the sort of managing director of the institution.
This is why I say report dotted line. But yes, the advice. Yes.
Because they should be helping you with the risks, you know, investigating risks and recommending possible remedial actions and working together with you.
Exactly. That's what
and they do. Being able then, together with you, to report to the audit committee. Is it not how it functions?
Well, to an extent.
Because the audit committee would then help you to manage what the auditor general or the... Who audits your books? Auditor general. Yes. To close the gaps in terms of the management letters and everything that the auditor general gives you.
That's perfect. That's exactly how it is.
Is that how
it
functions?
Yeah, that's how it functions. I think as far as the internal, I think maybe you know the issue of when Madam Chair, you said they report to me, they don't actually report to me, but they advise to me. But you know you can't have the audit, the internal audit, reporting that only to the CEO because they are supposed to audit me as well. So.
But I'm saying they're working with you. Of course, if anything affects you, they cannot come to you. They have a right to go to the audit committee.
Yes.
But in as far as possible, they work with you.
Yes.
so that you can implement even before you go to the audit committee. Is it how it
100%.
Okay.
100%. That's how it is.
That's the understanding we needed. But then, because why, the question by Babu Babanza was, I saw his face, his facial expression when you were saying you have external people serving as an internal audit unit. I think he wants to follow up on that so that he understands why not utilize the internal people. Is it because of shortage? Is it what? What is...
No.
Ask himself. Yeah. Follow up.
Yes, Chairperson, you're right. But the... I was almost asking, if you're saying Kobodo and them are doing your internal audit, who are they? Are they under the employ of SAMAF or EDD? What exactly are they? Why do you call them internal? And then you say here, but you give the impression that they are, you have outsourced this. What does outsourcing mean in this particular regard? Because then you have the external auditors who come to look into your books, which happens everywhere, in corporate world, in the public service. That's understandable. But when you talk internal, my understanding would be you have a team of people employed internally to do that function and report to whoever, so that by the time you call in external auditors, your books are ready and all of you responsible, accountable to whoever are ready to account, because it's in an internal setting. And that I'm raising that question because there is an expense involved here, which then makes it difficult for me to understand.
I think maybe to try that to assist. I think in terms of the treasury, they operate under PFMA, and one of the requirements is to establish that, and they are allowed to source out the service if they cannot, if they don't have the capacity within to do so. You must remember the auditors, you need to get a qualified auditor to do that within the institution. The audit unit must be led by a qualified auditor. That's why I was asking whether they can find a qualified auditor to employ within the institution itself. Because that's, I think, the gist of your question. Why do you have to go and employ an external service provider instead of doing it yourself here? Because perhaps Kobodo was supposed to be the committee, forming part of the committee. That would have been... Because now you are paying two external people. You have people who are doing your audit within the audit committee, and then you have your specialized people who are doing also the thing. And Treasury doesn't have a problem with that, and the AG doesn't have a problem with that. It means it's within. It means it is okay, because it should have been raised as a matter of emphasis here if it was not complying. It was not a compliance matter. So perhaps we need to advise in this regard, that you employ people in this manner. Maybe you are saving out of this instead of getting full-time people. But is it a good practice? I think that's the question we have to ask you. Mansur did.
Yes, so we don't come again on the same issue. If you can respond in conjunction with the audit and risk committee, because also risk committee, their responsibility, or one of their responsibilities, is to advise, like the audit committee does. If you can maybe answer them as one.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. As he has already indicated what the role of audit committee is, I'll just touch on the risk committee. The risk committee also reports to also works hand in hand with the chief executive. If you look at our setup, we have 9 provincial offices. What happens is that all these provinces have to do the risk register on monthly basis. What are the issues which we should manage? So there is a risk committee which looks at how this risk should be mitigated. And once that has been done, normally the risk committee meets another 2 days before the audit committee meeting. So that the chairperson of the risk committee will then report the risks which might be serious to the audit committee, and so that the audit committee will be able to advise as to how these things could be dealt with.
I think the question is, why is it not incorporated in the work of the audit committee? Why do you have to isolate? Because one of the functions of the audit committee is to identify the risks. I think that's the question, Mansu did. Am I correct? Okay, we're not listening. Must I let it pass after that explanation? Okay. I'm saying, the way I understood your question was that the risk management is part of the audit, internal audit unit work. So why are they divorcing that from the internal audit work instead of incorporating that into that? So you don't have two separate entities doing the same thing and the other one being paid for just auditing, whereas the responsibility should be...
Let me indicate that our setup is like this. The chairperson of the risk committee is the member of the audit committee. So the members of the risk committee are internal sum of staff. So there is it's not a separate committee in a staff, but they have to indicate that because it is led by an outside person.
Yeah, it is. This is required by PFMA. If you look on page 8 of this document, it says something about the two committees. It's just a requirement. But the risk committee, like Matomo said, is chaired by a member of the audit committee. So it's not that they're just looking at the risks slightly differently, but. You know, they're all oversight committees, but there's no real duplication here. There's no duplication.
In terms of the financing, I think that's where the challenge is. While they are reporting, the one is external, partly external, the other one is fully external. It's partly external because it's sort of a subsidiary of an external. If I were to use that the business terminology,
is it the internal committee?
The risk management committee. Is it a risk management committee that you're talking about?
Yeah.
And if that is partly internal, partly external.
No, the internal are just people like me and Matomo. We don't earn twice. We are just there to make sure that those risks that are identified, we look at those risks, identify them, and highlight them.
So there are but no financial implications.
No, there's no financial implication except for the chairperson who's a member of the. Audit
obviously earning as a member of the audit
committee.
Yes. He's not earning twice.
Mm. No.
Okay. Is that satisfied? Are you satisfied with the response?
In a way, yes. But really, I'm trying to read here, the function of the two people in conjunction with the report that we have here, that if we have these two people, how come really we we move on and on and on and on without detecting what is exposed by the report here. What are they doing on a monthly basis if they didn't detect what was going to happen here?
Did they,
is that clear, the question? Are you understanding the question? And then you want to come on the question?
Yeah, if you look at the report, maybe the AGS emphasis challenges as well and the way forward. Earlier on, I asked how long have these people been in the system before you discover all this mess? And we have this audit and risk management people who are there to advise, you know, to identify challenges, you know, tenuously, instead of you going on and on and on, people who are incompetent and having this loss that we have here.
To note 20 of the financial statement, which should deal with expenditure management.
Yes,
and then you have procurement and contract management issues. That are risk issues that needs to that you are referring to. Perhaps I'm trying to simplify your question. The issues that you alluded to earlier on, what the question is asking, for instance, it's talking about the financial officer who submitted financial statements for auditing that were not prepared in all material aspects in accordance with GRAP, South Africa's GRAP for trading entities. And also it's required by PFMA Section 41. The capitalization reserve also, deferred grant income, interest income, accruals, loan impairment, and expenditure were subsequently corrected. I think they were subsequently corrected after the notifications by the thing. But then there are other issues then. Can we deal with the emphasis of matters with respect to some of the issues. That was supposed to be, I think the gist of the question by ma'am is that we have these people who are so qualified that they could have assisted us in really identifying those risk areas and also assisting us in making sure that we mitigate the risks. But the fact is that we still find matters of emphasis, you know, identifying such issues that are everyday management issues. Yeah, I think the issue is the value for money, if I understand it well. That's how I interpret the question. And whether they're giving us value for money.
This is a difficult question, but let me try to answer this. The responsibility to prepare financial information or financial statements, as well as the responsibility of handling financial information, is management's responsibility. It's no one else but management. So here we have a institution that does not have a CFO, that does not have a chief financial officer. We have a junior officer who's now responsible for the financial division, and you know that's one of the issues we have to take into account when we look at this. that while the internal auditors would come and look at what we've done, and bearing in mind that audit, by its very nature, is an event after the fact. We go, we do things, and then the auditor comes and then says, but this you are supposed to have treated that way. But the sad part is we would have treated it wrongly in the first place. And what they are reporting, the auditors here, is to say, look, you are supposed to have treated this thing in this way, but you did not. So this is why we're having these areas, areas of emphasis. You'll notice that all of these have been addressed. We passed through the correct adjustments and all those things. But you know, but like I say, by the very nature, the audit would come. The purpose of audit is to unravel that which has already been done wrong. Now, they not done wrong because we don't have the qualified, skilled personnel to handle that issue. So I think that should be the answer we're giving. That it happened, of course, yes, but we did not really have. We mentioned it earlier. We mentioned it even in our challenges that we did not have the appropriately qualified officials to handle this. And yes, it was a challenge up to now, and hopefully it will not be a challenge going forward as we're moving on to the other environment.
Okay. From what you're saying, Mr. It justifies the reason why you employed a consultant. And in that case, I think the only people who might get worried because of the measure are consultants and not the officials. Because they've been, paid for nothing looking at this report here. And the other normal circumstances, especially senior management, we have monthly reports or quarterly reports. That's why I keep on asking for how long have they been in the system. And why they detected maybe in 6 months or so when people do their work. Internal auditing, they are there every day in the institution.
No, I think it's slightly different, ma'am. They are not there every day in the institution. Maybe that's where the problem is. They are not there every day. They came. I cannot. I think they came. They come one. They come four times. So it's not people that are there every day. They come four times, so quarterly, if you like. And yes, we don't have the fully fledged internal audit unit in the company.
Yes, granted, I agree with you. But if they report four times, it means it took. That is the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, and fourth quarter. The consultants not having the wisdom to identify the risk that is there.
Madam Chair, there will always be there are issues of the issues that the auditor will find when he does the audit. Some of the things could have happened, when the internal audit was not there. Like I said, at the end of the day, we should recognize that it is as management, it's our responsibility to put the financial information together. So if we did not do that, I think simply because we did not have appropriately qualified officials, I think we should apologize.
So you're saying the internal auditors come four times a year, and the committee?
I think they also sit four times.
I think that's an anomaly. Really, that's why you find these challenges. Because internal audit is supposed to be there on daily management level, according to Treasury regulations. It has to. And then the internal committee, the committee, audit committee is the one that meets four times a year, according to the rules. Yes.
clarify that. They don't come, the internal orders don't come four times. They a first cycle, second cycle, third cycle, and third cycle. They could spend a 2-3 weeks with us and go and prepare the report, which will be tabled at the...
So they are managing on a quarterly basis. That's what you're saying. But still, it might leave space in between, because at least a monthly basis, that's where you won't be having a gap in between. Maybe something that you'd want to look at. Okay, members, unfortunately, really, we went beyond the time allocated for farmers. I know we have questions that we've asked that were not responded to, and I think follow-up info was promised, and we're going to make sure. I hope that Gwegwe has noted all those issues, and we're hoping that... that Dima Thoman, that Dima Mandela will be able to respond back to us within the next 7 days, so that we are able then to report, also to finalize our report. Actually, we'll be finalizing our report in the next week, so we definitely don't have that much time, because we are following the process required by Parliament, which has very strict timelines, unfortunately. But let me thank the members really for the work done, and also thank Samaf for the improvement, I must say. You know, these questions indicate, you know, the improvement on your part, because normally we just look at what is presented. We don't have questions because information doesn't assist us in asking questions. So this is really meant to assist you to operate much better, actually to service our people in a better way. We are partners in this, and don't take us as them and you. We are part of the same family. Because if you succeed, we all succeed. We all have smiles on our faces. Because we don't want to remain underdeveloped forever. We also want to be called developed, one day a developed country. So we are banking on you as farmers, really. Whatever you'll be called going forward under one entity, but I guess you'll still be doing the work that is supposed to be done. Counting on you really to service accordingly, our people accordingly. So thank you very much for your appearance to the committee, and the way you've prepared your documents and the responses provided to the committee. And we can only wish you well in your work. Thank you very much, and the meeting stands adjourned.